You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book about the dramatic rise and fall of cryptocurrency and the fate of many of the people involved. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about the power of representation.
In 2018, a photo exhibit opened at the Payne Art Center in Oshkosh. The Color Brave photo project, Black and Brown Faces, A New Narrative, was the culmination of years of work by community leaders to show the complexity and beauty of people of color in the Fox Valley. At the center of the project was Tracy Robertson. She spoke with Jimmy Gutierrez about her experiences in Oshkosh in a recent episode of Human Powered, a podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities.
In Chicago, I always took blackness for granted because everybody else was black. Coming here and being one of the few really forced me, required me to be in this leadership position.
In 2014, Tracy moved to Oshkosh and almost immediately threw herself into community work.
People would ask me if I'd moved here because of the prison. And that didn't feel like a very safe welcome for me. People made assumptions that I had moved here from the ghettos of Chicago. And while I am from Chicago, I live in a pretty upper middle class community. So the assumption that I had escaped the ghettos of Chicago for the safety of Oshkosh, Wisconsin, was really problematic for me. So we started what we call Color Brave Community Conversations.
These conversations have moderators, and Tracy was one of them. And how it works is that they would show a video clip or a scene from a movie about race or a racialized incident. Moderators would then give people some structure to unpack what they saw, and people were into it. But one night, a woman asked,
"What's next?" And I said, "I don't know what you mean. This is what we're doing." And she says, "No, what's next?" She says, "Because what I've come to notice in the times I've been here is that you're preaching to the choir. Like, the people who are showing up are the people who have a vested interest in this work, right?" And she says, "How do we get places like the police department, the city, the stakeholders in this community, how do we get them at the table?" And I said, "I don't know."
Tracy started reaching out to community contacts, sharing her story, brainstorming possibilities. She ended up connecting with Paul Van Aken, a UW Oshkosh professor. And he's the person who suggested a photo exhibit.
So I just took that idea and kind of ran with it and said it would be a great way to shift the narrative. Because people of color are as complex as any other group of people, right? And the reasons that they move to a certain community and the reasons that they stay in a community are varied. You know, some people moved here for love. Some people moved here for career opportunities. And to put us in that little box, it kept me up at night for many years. And so when Paul Van Aken sparked this idea to me, I was like, let's do that.
So a bit about the photos. They are these striking and expressive studio portraits of people of color who live in the area. And underneath each individual photo, you can read a bit about people's lives and experiences.
We really wanted these stories to be meaningful, and we wanted these stories to stay true to each person's voice and experience.
On April 20th, 2018, Color Brave debuted at the Payne. Admission was free, and the gallery was packed. Tracy knew from the beginning that these stories couldn't stay housed in a fancy art museum. They ended up touring all across the Fox Valley. It traveled so much, actually, that the photos were getting worn out. And that's where the idea to turn this into a book came from.
So I have a 6-year-old grandson who was born in Neenah, Wisconsin. And I love that he has that as a point of reference. He goes to school all day and rarely sees, you know, black men who look like him, right? Adults that look like him. There are no teachers in his school that identify as a person of color. And so that makes me really proud to know that there are schools in our community that have this book. And for some kids, that might be the only representation that they get.
That story comes to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
As we heard, that story was featured in the podcast Human Powered. The podcast's newest season, Humanity Unlocked, is out now and focusing on people impacted by the justice system in Wisconsin. Now, Sam Bankman-Fried, founder of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, has been charged with 7 criminal counts of wire fraud, securities fraud, money laundering, and related conspiracy charges. His trial began last week in New York. Here's Bankman-Fried responding to the collapse of the company FTX last year.
I didn't ever try to commit fraud on anyone. I was excited about the prospects of FTX a month ago. I saw it as a thriving, growing business. I was shocked by what happened.
Our next guest has been following that story and the wider, weird, and wild world of cryptocurrency for years now and shares his reporting in a new book. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you or do you invest in cryptocurrency, the big names like Bitcoin or the smaller players? How about NFTs? Did you make money or lose money on those investments? Do you feel like you got ripped off at some point? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Zeke Fox is an investigative reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek and Bloomberg News. His new book is Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. Zeke, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Zeke, cryptocurrency, a household word for some people, an alien concept for many others. Can you give us a brief, a couple line description of what the heck cryptocurrency is?
So when I got into this, I've been an investigative reporter for, 15 years now, but I didn't really know much about crypto. I just started hearing about it like everybody else. I had a friend from high school who was texting me and saying I should buy something called Dogecoin. It's actually Dogecoin. I knew that much. And I set him straight and I told him it was a dumb idea. It's based on nothing. It's just a currency that's got a picture of a dog on it. There's really nothing there. And he didn't care. He bought it anyway. And the price started to go up because Elon Musk, the billionaire Tesla founder, was tweeting about it. And Jay made so much money that he sold out. He went to Disney with his family. He sent me pictures. He sent me a text saying, "I am freaking Nostradamus." And I have to admit, I was a little bit jealous. And so I decided to investigate and to figure out, what are all these random coins? Why are their prices going up and up? Why can nobody really explain them to me? What's behind this mania? Because Jay wasn't the only one getting rich. And what I found was that, a lot of these coins have various purposes. There's a whole story behind them that often can sound really good, but a lot of the activity boils down to people like Jay, who send some money to an app like Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX or Coinbase or Crypto.com, and they pick one of these wild-sounding coins and are essentially just gambling on the price going up. And it's a huge percentage of the activity in this whole crypto boom was just that. Wasn't based on any sort of real world use of this technology.
And Zeke, so much of this feels new and completely different than anything that came before. But you point out at one point there is precedent, something called a pump and dump scheme, going back to railroad stocks with no actual railroads attached in the 1800s to, the 1980s penny stocks and things like that. How much of that has that been a core of a lot of the cryptocurrency businesses? Basically, we're going to boost the value of these worthless stocks and we're going to sell out at the right time and make money. And the people who buy it from us, well, they're out of luck.
Yeah. I mean, I think a big percentage of crypto is kind of similar to these pump and dump schemes. You've got some sort of promoter who says, "Hey, I've got this great new coin. It's the future of money," or "it's going to revolutionize the financial system, cut out middlemen." And maybe the creator of this coin is a computer programmer who actually believes in the idea, but a lot of hype men get in early. They acquire the coins at a low price. And by the time you or I hear about them, the scheme's well on its way and the price is actually near where it's going to peak. And when we buy, the end is near and the prices collapse soon. And what we saw with the whole market is that it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. the total value of all cryptocurrencies hit $3 trillion. And then inevitably last summer, most of them collapsed. But along the way, there were a lot of crazy stories and a lot of people got really, really rich.
I want to talk about one particular figure in the news in court this week. I believe Sam Bankman-Fried, I mentioned FTX. Now, you interviewed him when he was at the peak, really. And, you know, as you're talking to him, he's like, hold on, I have to do this International Economic Conference speech and things like that. And you talked to him after it all fell apart. You got to hang out with him for a while there. The central question is, was he, and I think it's a central question in court, was he deliberately defrauding people, or was he, as he said, somebody who could just sort of accidentally misplace $8 billion in an accounting error? What is your read on that?
So I just want to give the listeners a little explanation of what his company was, FTX. And you could think of it like a casino where people would go bet on different cryptocurrencies. And it was an app that you'd have on your phone. And people sent in real money, and then they gambled on Dogecoin or Ethereum or Cardano or whatever. They're looking at their account. They think they can see their stack of chips has gotten bigger. But come last November, a lot of the gamblers at FTX all asked for their money back all at once. And FTX revealed that the money was gone. And if you were not one of the lucky ones to get out early, you lost it all. So, and that's where this missing $8 billion figure comes from. So when I flew down to the Bahamas after this collapse to interview Sam, it really looked like something fraudulent had happened. I mean, $8 billion doesn't just disappear. But what he told me was that there had been some sort of accounting mix-up and that he just hadn't been paying any attention to the money coming in and out of his company. Now, this was a little hard for me to believe because here we have, you know, this crypto genius, went to MIT. He was a trader at Jane Street Capital, a very respected firm on Wall Street. He'd conquered the crypto world. I mean, he was testifying before Congress on how finance should be regulated. Venture capitalists were giving him money at insane valuations. He was worth $20 billion at one point. And now here he was saying, oh, actually, I can't really count very well. I was paying so little attention that I didn't realize this $8 billion was gone. So I didn't find that a very convincing defense in the moment. And it's become even less convincing since then. He's on trial now in federal court in Manhattan. And I've been attending the trial and I've seen two of his colleagues, best friends of his from since they were teenagers. And these guys have said, yes, a fraud was committed. And one of them said, one of them had pleaded guilty. He'd said, you know, I committed a fraud. I did it with Sam. This wasn't any accident. It happened due to our actions.
We're talking to journalist and author Zeke Fox about his new book, Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. Coming up, a text message leads to an international scam. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with author and journalist Zeke Fox about his new book, Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. Zeke, one of the most shocking parts of your book in some ways is when you get a mysterious text message, a pretty blatant scam, it turns out, and it leads you to a human trafficking operation in Cambodia. What happened?
So by this point, I've been looking into crypto for more than a year, and I'd started to hear that it was popular for illicit activities. I mean, honestly, I heard that from the start, but I was starting to get really curious about how criminals exactly were using crypto. And I got a text message, one of these ones that we all get that says, oh, like, hey, Bill, did you pick up the cat litter on your way home? And I decided to play along, and I started chatting with someone who said her name was Vicky Ho. She started sending me pictures of herself. She was an attractive young Asian woman whose face had been heavily photoshopped to look kind of like an anime character. She started telling me about her wonderful lifestyle that she afforded through her genius Bitcoin trading. And I'd heard about these kinds of scams, so I wanted to see how it worked. But one of the hallmarks of them is they really try to lure you in with a fake flirtation and friendship before they ask for money. So it took several days of me chatting with her every morning before she said, hey, you know, I just made this great Bitcoin trade. Why don't you download this special app and you can try too? Now, I sent her some money. Then I, using the cryptocurrency called Tether that I'd been investigating, then she disappeared when I told her I was an investigative reporter. But as you alluded to, the really horrible part of these scams, which are called pig butchering, because they fatten you up before they slaughter you and take all your money. These people who send the spam text messages are often in Southeast Asia, in Cambodia or Myanmar. And while they're sending you these messages, they themselves are also victims. They've been tricked into traveling to these countries with offers of high-paying jobs and gambling or customer service. And then when they get there, they're held in these office towers and they're forced to scam. And they're told that if they don't meet their quota, they'll be beaten, tortured, or even killed. So I went out to Cambodia to see this for myself because it sounded like a conspiracy theory. And there's whole giant towers, whole office parks, where every floor is workers who've been trafficked, who are forced to run these crypto and gambling scams 24/7. It's become like a huge international incident, been raised at the United Nations now.
As you mentioned, one of the main use cases that was obvious to people from the beginning with cryptocurrencies was illicit activity, whether it's that kind of scam or selling drugs or whatever it might be. Have people found other solid use cases where they could say, yeah, cryptocurrency is better for this kind of transaction than a dollar?
So for Vicky Ho, who scammed me, crypto is great because once I zapped her, I sent her $100 worth of Tether. There's no refunds. I don't know her real name. And my money moves from the U.S. to a compound in Cambodia controlled by Chinese gangsters instantly. Whereas if she asked for my Visa card or a bank transfer, that would set off a lot of alarm bells at the bank or credit card company. So it's great for that. But what I found was that for regular people, it's very impractical. One of the things that Bitcoin proponents like to talk about is that El Salvador has made Bitcoin legal tender, and they say it was this huge success story. But I went down there. Nobody likes to use it. People would kind of laugh at me if I tried to use Bitcoin. The president actually announced that all stores have to take it. But if I ever asked a clerk, oh, can I pay for this with Bitcoin? They just sort of give me a dirty look and say, oh, the Bitcoin manager is not in today, or, you know, our internet's out. You sure you don't have cash? Because it's slow, it's expensive, and it's confusing. And why not just stick with regular dollars if you are able to, and if you're not worried about getting tracked?
Talking to Zeke Fox about his new book, Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. Zeke, you spend a lot of time in the book looking at that company you mentioned earlier, Tether, which is a stable coin, meaning in theory, every Tether dollar or whatever is backed by an actual existing U.S. dollar. They're still in business. They're still operating. I imagine you're still skeptical, but it's very hard to figure out what assets are out there backing up their stable coin.
That's a pretty good summary. That was the company that I picked that sucked me into this mystery. I wrote in the book, this company was basically quilted out of red flags. I've never seen anything like it in my years of investigating financial companies. But even as every crypto company that I'd heard of practically collapsed one after another, Tether was left still standing at the end. And the people who run it are now billionaires. It's one of the most profitable companies in the world, if you believe their numbers. But I'm still looking into this company and saving space in the paperback for an epilogue with what happens to them.
Apart from Tether, Zeke, what lessons do you hope people take away from your long-term in-depth look at crypto?
You know, the crypto people are great at saying, if you don't get it, it's because maybe you're not that smart or you just didn't spend enough time looking into this cryptocurrency. And I'm here to tell you, I spent 2 years looking into it. I'm not the smartest guy, but I am a financial reporter. And wherever I looked, I just saw there was nothing behind the curtain. And maybe somebody's going to come along again with a pitch for you that they've got the magic new coin that's going to be the really good crypto, the next Bitcoin. But I would be very skeptical of that because I heard it before. And a lot of the people who told me that are now either bankrupt or facing criminal charges or other kinds of lawsuits. So I definitely watch out.
Zeke, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Zeke Fox, author and investigative reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek and Bloomberg News. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the latest national jobs report was way better than analysts had expected. Find out what is driving the job market and what it all means for inflation, interest rates, and your job prospects. And Wisconsin has a lot of pretty famous tourist sites, but there's even more great stuff if you go off the beaten path. Explore the rest of the state with the authors of the book Secret Wisconsin, a guide to the weird, wonderful, and obscure. You can start sharing your recommendations right now. If you have a favorite place you wish people knew more about, actually, anywhere in the state, let us know about it. You can either post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or send us an email. That's ideas@WPR.org. Again, ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the Biden administration is moving ahead with sections of wall on the U.S. southern border, saying it's required under current funding bills, while large numbers of people cross Central America from Venezuela and other countries. We'll get the latest on border and immigration policy. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, growing up in the Midwest, I remember learning the history of the region something like this. There were Native Americans here before European settlers came, but then American and European immigrants came in the 1800s and settled a mostly empty, unpopulated wilderness. If you look at maps of the history of the region, you can see Wisconsin as a French possession, then a British territory, then part of the newly created United States, even though the indigenous population was larger than the European population until well into the 1800s. Our next guest says there's a huge story hidden by commonly held views of history, of efforts to expand the boundaries of American statehood by taking land from Native Americans, and of resistance to those efforts by the indigenous people of Wisconsin and the wider Midwest. In his new book, he tells the story of treaties made and violated, land stolen and sold, and the Native leaders, U.S. government officials, and others in the middle of the story. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about indigenous tribes and the colonization of Wisconsin? What do you remember learning about that period in history? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Witkin is a professor in the Department of History and the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. His latest book is called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. It was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about this effort that's at the heart, I think, of your book, correcting this gap that I certainly grew up with in my understanding of the history of our region?
Yeah, I think the way you phrased it here at the beginning, that thinking about the history of Wisconsin, or at least the non-native history, as a colonial history, as a history of this colonization of Wisconsin, I think that's kind of new to most people. And I think that's one of the things that I wanted to recover, that this wasn't a state or a continent that was sort of empty and settled by pioneers who tamed a wilderness, but rather it was an indigenous continent, and its settlement by non-native people was an act of colonization.
The idea from even before the United States became a country that was at the heart of this seems to be, okay, we English, the English settlers, we define use of land in this way, a person holds title to this piece of land and improves it. And Native Americans aren't doing that, not in the way we'd expect. That, therefore, that gives us, the English, and then the Americans, the right to take that land. That seems to be at the heart of so much of westward expansion, including here in what was the Northwest Territory.
Absolutely. I mean, so this is the sort of idea of discovery, or sometimes called the doctrine of discovery. And this is the idea that when Europeans arrive in the Americas, and in North America in particular, that they found a new world, and that that new world was, for all intents and purposes, uninhabited because it didn't have sort of recognizable forms of property or private property like you would have in Western Europe. And with that as a sort of framework, the original colonial project allowed monarchs from Europe to say, I've discovered this land, it's unsettled, and therefore I can claim it by right of discovery. The right of discovery becomes a way in which they grant crown charters to colonies in the Eastern Seaboard. There's the Seven Years' War where the revolution, or Seven Years' War where the two competing empires, France and Great Britain, compete with one another. France loses, they cede their claims to North America to the British. And following the revolution, at the settlement of that war, the British Empire cedes huge swaths of North America to the United States, all through this idea about a right of discovery, that they were essentially passing land that had been claimed because it was unsettled by kings, claimed as a possession, incorporated into empire, and then transferred to the Republic. And so the Republic basically takes up that same ideological project, the idea that the territory in the west of the Appalachian Mountains that had been granted to it by the Treaty of Paris that ends the Revolution is unsettled land, and the U.S. sets out to kind of settle that. And the story of Wisconsin is totally wrapped up in that process, the settlement where the United States has to come to grips with the fact that the land is not empty, that it's occupied by Native people, and that settling isn't just a matter of moving settlers onto a forest and changing it, but rather engaging with Native people and then actively sort of working to colonize them and their land.
We operated under this Northwest Ordinance here in the Northwest Territory that included Wisconsin. Can you talk about what that was and how it set the stage for how that land would be taken and then distributed?
Sure. So the Northwest Ordinance is the way by which the United States figures out what to do with it. So when we come out of the Revolution, all this land, really from the Appalachian Mountains out to the Mississippi, the United States regards as part of its public domain. That is, it's the land that I mentioned had been transferred by the Great Britain to the United States. It's not settled by Americans, therefore they consider it public land that's controlled by the federal government. And they decide the way to settle that orderly with the Northwest Ordinance, which is a land law. And the ordinance is a way that you can both organize territory and that will eventually become a state, and then also sell the land within that territory. And the way the Northwest Ordinance works is that when you get 5,000 free white men, that's enough to organize a space as a territory, so the territory of Michigan or the territory of Indiana. Once the territory is organized, the progression goes from 5,000 free white men to 60,000 free white settlers. When you've reached the 60,000 population mark, the territory can petition the federal government to enter the Union as a state with its own constitution, and then it enters the Union as a state with all the rights and privileges that other states. And so that's the model that's used in order to create territories, turn the Northwest Territory into specific territories, the states that are now Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota were all part of the original Northwest Territory. And for the most part, in the southern tier of the Northwest Territories, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, they fill up really fast, and they reach the requisite population of 60,000 persons to become states and enter the Union all within the early 1800s. Ohio is a state in 1803. Illinois and Indiana, I think, are 1808 and 1818, respectively. They become states in the Union. And it's in part because those territories are all connected to the Ohio River, to the Mississippi, and the Mississippi connects that territory to the sort of larger market economy of the U.S., New Orleans, St. Louis. And so it makes sense if you want to be a farmer in Ohio or in Illinois, you can get your product to a market than a U.S. market. But above the Ohio River, what would now be, say, Michigan and Ohio territory, it makes a lot less sense to settle. And so those territories actually remain territories for a long time. Michigan territory, which is formed in 1805, actually stays a territory, doesn't get the 60,000 population threshold until 1837. And Wisconsin isn't even organized as a territory until 1837. Before that time, it's part of Michigan. And as late as 1820, The Michigan territory, which would have been Michigan now, plus Wisconsin, plus Minnesota, had less than 20,000 non-native settlers. And that's, you know, going into 1820. So that's really late. It's not till the Erie Canal is completed and opens in 1826 that it begins to make sense to start moving into these more northern parts of the Northwest Territory, because only then can you start getting things like agricultural products or timber out to a market in the U.S.
Talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. You can join in if you have questions at 800-642-1234. Michael, a huge part of the story you tell is of how natives in Wisconsin and beyond reacted to this drive to populate the states with settlers from out east. What were some of the key points in the story you researched?
There's several key points. There's an important treaty in 1837 that cedes a huge swath of Wisconsin, now is Wisconsin, I think something around the nature of 11 million acres. And it's a treaty that the indigenous peoples tell American officials they don't want to cede. And there's not a lot of population pressure in 1837 for that northern Wisconsin territory. But the U.S. basically tells the native people that they have to cede it or it'll be taken from them. And so they do. And they are compensated something about, I think, in the nature of around 13 cents per acre, which the U.S. can then turn around and sell through the Northwest Ordinance for $1 an acre, so making an enormous amount of profit. And then that property often enters into circulation and becomes private property of individuals who sit on it and don't necessarily develop it right away, and maybe sit on it for 10 or 15 years where it can sell for, say, $80 an acre. So you have this sort of massive transfer of land and wealth from Native people to the federal government, and then the transfer of that land as a public domain to the individual settlers in the United States, basically a subsidized way of settling the settlement, because you can sell that land at a way below market rate because the government has a monopoly when they acquire it from Native people. So it's a process where you're sort of facilitating the colonization by creating a sort of a monopoly on land sales and then making that land available in a really affordable manner to most people in order to encourage immigration.
And that's at the heart of the idea of plunder you introduce, actually even in the subtitle of your book. Can you talk about the scope of a financial benefit to the United States, individuals, and to the federal government of that sort of forced appropriation of land and then distribution of it?
This was one of the things that really was a surprise for me. And if you think about the United States and the histories we all get in elementary school and junior high school and high school, these standard kind of survey histories, when you get to the early Republic, where you tend to find Indians in that history in a standard survey is with the Trail of Tears, the really tragic removal of Native peoples from what would then be the Southeast. You know, you can think places like Georgia, North Carolina, the Alabama, Mississippi, the Trail of Tears. That's pretty common. And that makes sense with the story. There's a hunger for land. Indians are facing pressure. They're removed. You don't have that in the Northwest Territories. I mean, to some extent, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, as I said, fill up really quick. But the land in territories like Michigan and Wisconsin, there's just less demand for it. And because there's less demand for it, the federal government sort of needs to entice people to move in. And what ends up happening is, rather than having a pressure to remove Indians, people in states like Michigan and Wisconsin quickly discover that having Indians in place as sort of colonized subject is way more lucrative than kicking them off and taking over their land. And I say it's more lucrative because the treaty process where federal representatives of the federal government come in, negotiate with tribal members, often through people that are traders or Indian agents. And most of the traders and Indian agents are intermarried with the tribe, so they have indigenous wives and children. And they negotiate these treaties to cede land in exchange for a payment of money. Oh, I mentioned that before with the 1837 treaty. So you get a $20,000 cash payment for 10 years for the sale of this 13 million acres. But when that payment is made, and the federal officials would show up with specie, with actual currency, which is often rare in early 19th century America, that payout usually went something in the neighborhood of 90% or more to traders or merchants who would claim that Native peoples owed them debt from the fur trade, and debt that hadn't been repaid. And so each of these payments that were coming in to compensate Native people for the sale of land by a forced treaty, the money for that would mostly not end up in Native hands. It would mostly end up in the hands of merchants, traders, agents, people who were engaged in this fur trade. They would take that money and invest in their business, develop it in that way. The same merchants who were claiming that that money is debt would also be hired out by the government. Part of the payment was a cash payment in compensation for the land cession, but part of it was, say, $10,000 in provisions and goods. The federal government would buy those from the same merchants who were claiming it as debt. So they're making money by claiming the cash as debt. They're making money by covering the provisions that are also part of the annual payment for land sales by providing that to the federal government. So basically, you've got the sort of the leaders of the Wisconsin Territory, the Michigan Territory, often people who are connected with the fur trade, that history, helping it transition out of the fur trade and out of the Indian era by facilitating these land transfers, which bring tons of cash into the state or territory, cash that they then themselves can claim. So there's a lot of money to be made in not removing the Indians like you do in, say, Georgia or Alabama, but keeping them in place and negotiating treaty after treaty, which brings cash in, which you can then claim. So that cash becomes a way in which people basically develop the infrastructure of their businesses and the state economy. And it's a way of basically not just taking land, but really taking the wealth and land together, kind of plundering the resources of the indigenous population in order to sort of economically develop the state and territory.
Talking to Columbia University History Professor Michael Witkin about the book Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. In his work, he focuses a lot on Wisconsin and the surrounding region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about his research and Native history in Wisconsin, the history of U.S. settlement in the region? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah,
can you hear
ahead,
me
Jeff.
Now?
Yep, go for it.
Well, this is living history, and it's very exciting to share with you that last year in 2022, we transferred land from the city of Superior, the Diocese of Superior, and the Douglas County back to the Fond du Lac tribe. First time they've owned land in Wisconsin, I think, since the Treaty of 1857. So under the right leadership, you can right some wrongs from the past, and it's an exciting time to remember that, 170 years later or something.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael, you are definitely thinking about this history you write about in the present day. What kind of things are you watching for with current land issues related to the descendants of the people you write about?
Well, that's a really interesting story, and I'm interested in those sort of land back sort of movements. A lot of the land in northern Wisconsin in northern Michigan, the UP, is ceded when there really isn't demand for it. There's maybe some demand for mining, some demand for timbering, but a lot of that land has then passed into sometimes public trust for counties or universities or other things. Sometimes it's passed into it was privately owned, but now it's owned. It's public land, and that restoring that kind of land, that's really fascinating to hear that kind of history. I've been interested in that. I think it's also quite interesting that a lot of the land that comes out of these treaties that I mentioned makes its way into the financial instruments that are used to create the land grant colleges in the United States, the Morrill Act, which mandated the creation of a land grant university in all the states in the Union, which is a university that focuses on agricultural training. Those universities are all funded through the Morrill Act, which used basically land that had been ceded by the tribes in the United States that have been turned into financial instruments like a bond and then sold or given back to the states, and the states then cashed those land scripts in order to fund the endowments for the land grant universities. Huge amounts of the territory that had been ceded in the 1837 treaty makes its way into the public domain that's then used for funding land grant universities. So, I mean, it's part of the public infrastructure of the United States comes from this transfer of land. And I think reckoning with that and coming to grips with it and finding things like in Superior where you can maybe give the land back if it's possible is a really interesting sort of recognition of this colonial history and sort of undoing some of the legacies of it.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Michael, I don't want to miss something in your book. It isn't all big picture stuff. You share real people and their stories. One amazing story was leaders from the St. Croix Band of Ojibwe journeying against the advice of, you know, federal officials to negotiate directly with President Millard Fillmore in 1852 with some consequences. Can you briefly share that story?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, it was one of my distant relatives was on that trip, and it was a moment where, when the treaties had been signed in Wisconsin, one of the provisions that leaders were making was that we won't be removed. And they were saying this is, you know, the era of removal. And they said, well, sign the treaties if you're going to force us, but we want to remain on our land. And so that treaty had been made in 1854. The U.S. government was making plans to go back and remove tribes from northern Wisconsin. And they got wind of it. Some leaders did, as you mentioned, and they sort of snuck off the reservation, made their way to Washington, D.C., and were able to secure an audience with the president and get his commitment to not remove them, to let them stay on their homelands. And so it's a kind of an amazing example of Ojibwe people fighting to remain in their homeland, taking whatever they could in order to preserve that homeland, the territory, that connection to that landscape. And in this case, the journey was kind of amazing. They got stopped in Detroit. The Indian Nation let them go on. They ran out of money in New York. They actually staged a dinner in a New York hotel where they invited people to come in and dine with the Ojibwe chiefs from Lake Superior to fund the rest of the trip to make it to D.C. So it was quite an amazing escapade in the 19th century, where Indians were sort of popular cultural figures, but they're also sort of real people fighting to maintain their homeland. And that's part of the story of why Native people in Wisconsin don't get removed. They fought and resisted to stay in their homeland. And I would put a final note, they brought with them letters from a lot of the towns in Wisconsin on the Superior shoreline who were telling federal government they wanted, in fact, Indians to stay, because they also recognized this political economy of plunder that I was mentioning. And they said, Indians are good neighbors, and so we don't want them removed. So they traveled with letters from non-Native peoples in Wisconsin who were also asking, along with the Ojibwe, to not let them be removed to Indian territory. Pretty amazing story.
Time for one more caller. Nancy is with us in Winneconne. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a few months ago, and there are some historical markers around the city, and they indicated that they were Potawatomi who lived in that area, and they were forced to go west. I don't remember exactly where they had to go, but I recall that they had to leave.
Nancy, thanks for the call. And Michael, do you want to see wider efforts to share the history that you recount in your book, whether it's that public sign or other venues?
Absolutely. I think people don't realize the extent to which the history, particularly the Midwest, is an indigenous history. And American history is really intertwined with indigenous history in a way that can't be separated. So thinking about that is really important. I think thinking about the way that our public lands get created or public universities get created off this kind of colonial relationship is super important. Helping people realize that there's a connection with Native people have to land that still exists today, that's historic, that precedes America, is really important when people see tribes exercising treaty rights, those sorts of things. So I'm all for getting this sort of message, this history out.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That's Michael Witkin, professor in the Department of History and the Center for Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. He was with us today to share his latest book. It's called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. That was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime. Stream live at WPR.org or check out our extremely extensive archives there. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Biden administration announced last week that it will build up to 20 miles of new border wall near the southern tip of Texas in the Rio Grande Valley. The president has faced criticism for the move after promising on the campaign trail that he wouldn't add any additional walls at the Mexican border. On Thursday, he defended that decision, telling reporters he didn't have a choice.
I'll answer one question on the border wall. The border wall, the money was appropriated for the border wall. I tried to get them to reappropriate, to redirect that money. They didn't. They wouldn't. And in the meantime, there's nothing under the law other than they have to use the money for what was appropriated. I can't stop that.
Do you believe the border wall works?
No.
Constructing these sections of walls also required the Biden administration to waive 26 environmental, public health, and cultural preservation laws because some of the wall would be built in the lower Rio Grande Valley National Wildlife Refuge. This comes just a few days after the Biden administration announced it would resume deporting some Venezuelan migrants with repatriation flights, while also granting temporary legal status to many Venezuelan migrants already in the country. We're catching up on the latest decisions from the White House as Biden's immigration policy remains in the spotlight. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Biden administration adding some sections of border wall? How do you think the White House should handle the country's immigration challenges right now? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Geronimo Cortina is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science and director of the Faculty Research Initiatives at Population Health at the University of Houston, where he researches American and Latino politics and immigration. He co-hosts the video podcast Party Politics on Houston Public Media. Geronimo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, why these particular locations on the border? What's the significance of the spots where it looks like these new sections of wall will go up?
Well, we're talking about Stark County in Texas, and it's, you know, the southern part of the state where it has been a place where we have seen an increasing activity of migrants trying to cross the border to the United States. And obviously, it's, you know, one of the places where building another piece of the wall could be, you know, from an engineering perspective or construction perspective, it's feasible to do so. So it's one of those places where they're looking at this particular place.
Now, President Biden had campaigned saying no more wall construction after the Trump administration. We just heard there him telling reporters this is congressional appropriation. He has to do this. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, like, if he wants to use the money for something else, that money needs to be a portion for something else. Unfortunately, this money is not a portion to be spent on something else. It's a portion and it's appropriated to be spent on building a wall. So on the one hand, the president could ignore, could delay the construction of the border wall if he chooses to do so, as many times the federal government does not necessarily spend the money that has been appropriated for several other purposes, regardless of, in this case, of the border wall. But in this case, the Biden administration has decided to do so, and it's going to be up to 20 miles in Stark County, as I mentioned before. You know, they're going to have 18-foot-high, 6-inch diameter bollards that is going to be embedded in this big, movable, concrete, buried style. And it's going to have all the goodies, right? It's going to include lighting, rods, detection technology, et cetera, et cetera. And the president has gotten a lot of pushback, even from members of his own party, saying that this is a 19th century or 18th century solution for a 21st century problem.
I know the border is very different from place to place. Do we have a sense for other places where some type of wall-like borders exist? Do they deter people crossing the border?
No, they do not. Border walls, we have seen an empirical evidence suggests that do not work. And the fact of the matter is that they do not work because, as Representative Cuellar said, you know, this is an old-fashioned, very old-fashioned draconian measure to try to manage immigration. So I think that the first point here is that, you know, many other administrations, the Trump administration, Obama administration, Biden administration, Bush administration, you name it, have attempted to control immigration. And control is one of those public policy issues that you do not control. You can manage immigration, right? But you can certainly not control it because it's very hard to impede the free movement of people, right, in other parts of the world, especially, you know, if you're walking from Nicaragua to the southern border of the United States, you know, it's very hard to control who's going to be moving from country to country. You have to have, for example, a lot of cooperation, in this case, from the Mexican government, that the Mexican government has cooperated with the Biden administration and also cooperated with the Trump administration in many facets of U.S. immigration policy. But once again, is not an approach in which you're trying to basically, have a rational way of approaching and managing migration flows, but trying to curtail and trying to control it, which in my opinion is not the wrong, it's the wrong way to approach this policy question.
Talking to Geronimo Cortina from the University of Houston, political scientist there, looking at the Biden administration announcement that they would move ahead with funding that exists to build sections of border wall on the border between Mexico and Texas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could perhaps comment on what you think the United States is, the federal government's capacity to process migrants, in particular through the court system, and process their applications for asylum. In my observation, it seems that the court system, particularly the judgeship, is seemingly lacking, and something that we really need to be working on. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Chris, thanks for the call. Geronimo, we've been hearing concerns for quite some time now that there is, as Chris says, a shortage of judges and other staff to process asylum applications and other things going on at the border. How big a problem is this?
It's a huge problem. And once again, that's part of the managing the migration flow system. So the immigration docket is completely overflown. It's the number of asylum applications that we have in our court system simply surpasses the number of immigration judges and the number of hearings that we can have. So this has two implications. And the first one is people that come to our country to seek asylum, right, in which, you know, we are a country of laws, and that country of laws allows for people to have these due process, given that these individuals may or may not have a legitimate claim. If they have a legitimate claim, then they have to go through the process of being vetted to see if the claim has merits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In this case, given that we don't have enough resources, immigration judges, number of hearings, so on and so forth, we are not, you know, abiding by our own rules and having people being processed by these facts. The other important implication is that if we had a system in which people can be processed, we can also deter the number of people that could be applying, right, for asylum. Asylum rules determine and are very strict in terms of who qualifies and who does not qualify for asylum in the United States. And simply not having that process very well cemented doesn't allow people to know if they do or not. And that creates, you know, perhaps certain incentives for people say, well, we can go and then we can just simply wait and see when this is going to happen. And in some cases is months, and in some cases can take years for people to be processed while being in a significant legal limbo in terms of their stay in the United States.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Geronimo, another concern about these sections of wall, as I understand it, not just on the immigration issue, environmental concerns for the landscape, for the wildlife species there, and cultural heritage concerns. What kind of things are people worried about?
Well, I mean, is a lot of species that are in the Rio Grande Valley go back and forth between Mexico and the United States. So these are just species that have, you know, annual or temporary migration patterns, and they just go back and forward without any or without caring about if there is a wall or if there is not a wall or anything like that. So it is, it would have a significant impact on the ecosystem. It will also have an important impact on a very already fragile ecosystem that happens in the southern border. And lastly, it will have impacts in terms of cultural heritage and communities that share a binational and bicultural heritage between Mexico and the United States.
We're talking to Geronimo Cortina, political science professor at the University of Houston, about the Biden administration's approach to immigration policy and the construction of some portions of a border wall in Texas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of the construction of another 20 or so miles of border wall, in this case on the Texas-Mexico border? What do you think of the Biden administration's current approaches to immigration? What questions do you have about who's coming to the southern border and why? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Geronimo Cortina, political science professor at the University of Houston who researches American and Latino politics and immigration. He's with us today for a look at the Biden administration decision to build about 20 miles of border walls on portions of the Mexican border in Texas and the broader approach to immigration from the White House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Gary is with us in Milwaukee. Gary, hello.
Hello. Well, I have a question. Obviously, both President Biden and your guests say that the wall does not work. And I'm trying to develop an opinion on this myself. But I'm wondering if someone is trying to come across the border and they encounter this wall, which I'm assuming is an intimidating structure, at least high enough to be a real problem, how would they get across the border at that point if the wall doesn't work? Or would they simply go around the wall and find another way into the country?
Gary, thanks for the call. Geronimo.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. And part of the answer is, well, I mean, if there is a will, there is going to be a way to, you know, just simply go over the wall. But also the wall in the southern border is not a continuous wall. So the wall is in terms of having, or it has very significant gaps. And those significant gaps just makes it that migrants just seek another entry point along the border, whether it's in Texas or Arizona or any other border state that would allow them to freely go back and forward. Obviously, we have thousands of miles that CBP is impossible simply to, you know, monitor and just look at it in terms of, you know, having, you know, significant presence, even new technology that has been deployed in terms of motion sensors. It takes, you know, a couple of minutes or in sometimes a lot of minutes for CBP officers to go to that point and check if the sensor was triggered, for example, by a animal just crossing the border like they normally do, or simply because it was triggered by people trying to enter the country without inspection. So it is very similar, like, for example, perhaps being in Wisconsin, you're more familiar with the Canadian border, is also very, very, very porous. And therefore, the border wall simply is not the most efficient solution, not only from a construction point of view, but also from a budgetary perspective, if we are actually devoting funds to something that we have seen in the past, since the 1990s, that the border wall has not been as successful to deter people entering the country without inspection.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call and the question. Marie joins us now in Kimberly. Marie, hi.
Hi there. My question is twofold. Number one, President Biden said that this is already appropriated by Congress and he cannot unappropriate it. So, and your guests agreed with that halfway. So my question is, how could I mean, I understand it can be delayed, and that would be great, but ultimately, the money is already appropriated by Congress. How can it be appropriated to something else, if that makes sense?
Gotcha. Marie, thanks for the call. Geronimo, I think you had mentioned Congress, if it was going to be spent by something else, Congress would probably have to reappropriate it. There is the thought that the Biden administration could have, I guess, slow-walked it in the meantime.
That is correct. Congress has the control of the checkbook, and the federal government has the control of how they're going to spend that money that has been already appropriated by Congress. It's an act. It's a legal act by Congress, and Congress would have to reappropriate it for another different purpose. According to President Biden, he tried to do that, but, you know, Congress said, no, this is going to stay as it stays. So that's one issue. And the other issue is, as I said before, is, you know, Congress, the federal government has, you know, can delay one way or the other the construction of the border wall. They cannot use the funds for anything else than building these new section of the border wall, but they can certainly slow down. And of course, you have the political ramifications of building or not building this section of the border wall in light of the 2024 presidential election.
Thanks for that call, Marie. We're talking to Geronimo Cortina from the University of Houston, looking at the Biden administration's immigration policy, including plans to build a little bit more border wall between Texas and Mexico. Geronimo, I want to talk about where people are coming from when they arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border. For a long time, it might have been from Mexico itself, then places in Central America. Now it sounds like more and more people are coming from Venezuela, neighboring countries where they initially fled Venezuela from in some cases, crossing the extremely dangerous Darien Gap to make it as far as Mexico. What do we know about who's coming and why?
Well, I mean, and this is to the point, right, that migration needs to be managed. And when I refer to management, is you need to have countries of origin on board, and you need to have, you know, policies that is going to allow people to make a rational decision one way or the other. And I said this with air quotes, rational, in the sense of staying at their country of origin, where they might have, you know, some opportunities to move forward in terms of economic opportunities, in terms of sending their kids to school, in terms of security, so on and so forth. Unfortunately, the situation in Venezuela in particular is extremely dire, right? It's a country that before 2000 was the gem of democratic transitions in Latin America. After Hugo Chavez got control over the coup of Hugo Chavez, the country has been in significant decline. And that decline was exacerbated by the oil prices crisis that we have a couple of years ago. So basically, the country has no infrastructure, no GDP, no economic growth, no industry, and people are just fleeing in masses. Why? Because just admire the dire conditions that people have there, that they are willing, right, to make this very treacherous trip from Venezuela, cross all Central America, cross Mexico, and then arrive at the U.S. border to attempt to enter the country and to a certain extent ask for asylum or any other reprieve that the federal government could provide. So you're talking about women, you're talking about children, you're talking about complete and utter desperation of people willing to risk their lives to have a chance to enter the United States. So when we're thinking about management of migration, we need to find and we need to understand what are those push factors that are making people leave their countries of origin. In the 70s, in the 80s, it was Mexico. Mexican migration has basically come to a halt. And in some reports, we have seen that Mexican migration has declined significantly over the past years. But now we're seeing that other people from other countries are coming. So this creates an opportunity for the Biden administration and for Congress, right? Because we have to remind ourselves that the final word in terms of immigration policy lies with the U.S. Congress. It is the House and it is the Senate that can change immigration policy. The fact of the matter is that over the past years, we have been trying to have comprehensive immigration policy, and clearly that has not worked in any shape or form. So what we need now is to have at least some sort of piecemeal immigration reforms that would allow the system to be up to date and would allow people to have a chance. If they want to come, well, they can do so in an orderly manner.
And just our last minute or so, Geronimo, you know, we've had various kinds of border security structures since at least the Bill Clinton administration. It seems like since then President Trump made the case for a wall, I guess with a capital W, it's got this political symbolic importance that makes it hard to talk about border security. Has the symbolism of the wall overcome sort of the practical debate over border security?
Well, I think so. I totally think so. It was a very smart political trick by former President Trump to get immigration into people's minds, right? But again, is from a policy perspective, we have seen. The evidence is there, the facts are there that the wall does not work as a tool to manage or control immigration that comes to the United States.
Geronimo, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Geronimo Cortina is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston, where he researches American and Latino politics and immigration. He joins today for a look at the Biden administration's approach to immigration as the White House announced new border wall construction on selected parts of the Mexican border in Texas. You can follow reporting on that from our colleagues at NPR. You can do that on our own Wisconsin website, WPR.org, or stay on top of the latest news with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a new invasive species may be coming to the neighborhood, been spotted around the Midwest. Meet the spotted lanternfly. Find out why it's a potential threat. Get a sense of what it looks like, how to spot it in your part of the state if it shows up maybe next year. And, of course, join in with your questions and find out how it fits into the wider picture of invasive species that we've seen here in the state in recent years. You can join in with your questions now. Email ideas at WPR.org, then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30. That's here on the Ideas Network. A big thank you to everyone who made a donation during our fall member drive over the last couple of weeks. Your gift makes Wisconsin Public Radio possible. It's support from people like Cynthia in Wanakee and Margie in Sparta that keeps great news, information, inspiration, and entertainment coming your way here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Now, if you're wondering what member drive, maybe you're out of town for the last couple of few weeks, you missed your chance. No, you didn't miss. There's still an opportunity. You can always give online at WPR.org. There are still, by the way, I hear some WPR belt bags available for a gift of $10 a month or more, or WPR baseball caps with a gift of $15 a month or more. Got to remember to ask who I need to talk about getting my own baseball cap for my sustaining gift. I'll keep you up to date on that. Again, a big thank you if you made a gift or you're a sustainer. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.